Good afternoon, everyone. I want to begin by reading from a report put out by the Barna Group. This report is based upon telephone interviews conducted by the Barna Group with a random sample of 1,003 adults selected from across the continental United States, age 18 and older, in May 2008. This group is a very reputable group, does a lot of study in terms of family, and the American way of life, the change that's taking place in the American way of life and in the American family. And they did a survey asking several questions about morality. According to George Barna, who directed the survey, the results reflect a significant shift in American life. "We are witnessing the development and acceptance of a new moral code in America," said the researcher and author, who has been surveying national trends in faith and morality for more than a quarter century. "Mosaics have had little exposure to traditional moral teaching and limited accountability for such behavior. They label adults ages 18 to 24 as mosaics." I don't know why they call them that, but that's who they're talking about. "Mosaics have had little exposure to traditional moral teaching and limited accountability for such behavior. The moral code began to disintegrate when the generation before them, the baby busters, ages 25 through 43 are labeled baby busters. The moral code began to disintegrate when the generation before them, the baby busters, pushed the limits that had been challenged by their parents, the baby boomers. Baby boomers are ages 44 to 62. I don't know what you're called if you're over 62. Crybabies, big babies, I don't know what. But anyway, they have mosaics, and then baby busters, and then baby boomers. I want to reread what they had to say there. "Mosaics have had little exposure to traditional moral teaching and limited accountability for such behavior." Those are the young adults. "The moral code began to disintegrate when the generation before them, the baby busters, pushed the limits that had been challenged by their parents, the baby boomers. The result is that without much fanfare or visible leadership, the U.S. has created a moral system based on convenience, feelings, and selfishness." That's what they're finding as they research and look into this very, very carefully. "The consistent deterioration of the Bible as a source of moral truth has led to a nation where people have become independent judges of right and wrong, basing their choices on feelings and circumstances. It is not likely that America will return to a more traditional moral code until the nation experiences significant pain from its moral choices." Now, that's a commentary on the United States of America, but it applies to other nations around the world, and especially in the Western world. And to me, that very condition is described at another time in history, found over here in Judges, chapter 21 and verse 25. Let's turn there. Judges 21 and verse 25. I've just finished an extensive study through the book of Judges. It sure does chronicle actions and attitudes of that time that are applicable to actions and attitudes of our time. Notice what it says here in Judges, chapter 21 and verse 25. "In those days there was no king in Israel. No leadership. Every man did that which was right in his own eyes. You figure out the way you want to live and live that way. It's up to you. It's your choice. There's no guidelines. There's no direction. You decide for yourself. It's every man for himself." And if you read the book of Judges, you'll see the results of that kind of thinking. And more, that's the kind of thinking taking place in the Western world and in the United States of America. If you think about it, that's the same kind of thinking and action that has taken place in the lives of church members who followed Mr. and Mrs. Herbert W. Armstrong for many, many years. But they have shifted away from that path and are now off track and getting more so all the time. And what is their basic fundamental way of doing things? They do things that are right in their own sight. They figure out the way they want to live. They figure out the way they want to conduct the quote-unquote work. They figure out the doctrines that they want to teach, and then they do that. They do that which is right in their own eyes. instead of absolutely being in line with the Bible and absolutely being in line with Mr. and Mrs. Armstrong as they followed Jesus Christ. Well, what about us? And especially, what about our families? This survey and other surveys put out by this organization tends to concentrate heavily on conditions in the American family. And I think it's accurate information. And it doesn't look good. And when you look into religion and you see the condition of families in religion, that's not looking very good either, according to this survey. And the same is true in, quote unquote, former members of the Church of God. Now, the study in religion is better than the study in atheists and agnostics, and better than the study in the general population that is, quote unquote, unchurched. But that's a comparative thing. It's still not where it should be if they are true Christians. Let's take a look not just at the trends around us, but more importantly, let's take a look at where we are as true Christians in our lives and especially in our families in God's church. Let's turn to Joshua chapter 24. You know, when you think of Joshua, many things come to mind. He had courage. He had faith. He was very loyal to Moses. If you see the instructions that Moses gave Joshua, while Moses was alive, Joshua followed them meticulously. But you keep on reading in the book of Joshua, and you will see that he also followed the instruction from Moses after Moses' death. He was a very loyal man, outstanding leader, excellent military strategist and tactician. He had so many qualities. But I doubt if very many people have noticed this quality in Joshua. Notice what he says here in Joshua 24 and verse 14. This was nearing the end of his life, and he was giving final instructions to Israel on how to continue to be the prosperous and peaceful nation that God had brought them to under the leadership of Joshua. Verse 14, Joshua 24, "Now therefore fear the Eternal and serve him in sincerity and in truth. And put away the gods which your fathers served on the other side of the flood and in Egypt, and serve you the Eternal. And if it seem evil unto you to serve the Eternal, choose you this day whom you will serve, whether the gods which your fathers served that were on the other side of the flood or on the other side of the Euphrates, or the gods of the Amorites in whose land you dwell." And here's the point. "But as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord." So Joshua also was an outstanding proponent of family, a godly family, of the institution of the family that was God-centered. And he, right here, brought it right down to the bottom line. You make your choices and you decide which way you're going to go, but here's my choice and here's the way me and my family are going to go. "But as for me and my house, we will serve the Eternal." That's one of my favorite phrases in a verse. One thing I want us to be careful that we don't overlook. Quite often this is quoted, and it's quoted as if he's just saying, "As for my family, we're going to serve the Eternal." And that is what he says, but he says more than that. The first thing he says is this, "But as for me," see, "me, as for me and my house, we will serve the Eternal." What can you and I say in God's church? What can you and I say about that point? "As for me and my family." As for me and my house. He's talking about his family. He's not talking about a structure called a house. "We will serve the Eternal." That's not the way it was in the time of Judges. And that's not the way it is very many places today, anywhere on the face of the earth. Those words can be mouthed. But in practical terms, it's getting harder and harder to find a family that is God-centered and that this can be said of them. "As for me and my house, we're going to serve the Eternal." We have to be those kind of families. And we are. But we need to get more so that way. Now, there was another man that God described like that in so many words. Let's turn over here to Genesis chapter 18. Genesis 18 and verse 19. He was a friend of God. What a compliment. His name was Abraham. And God was going to make a great people to come from Abraham and Sarah, and he did. But why Abraham? Well, he answers that question right here in verse 19 of Genesis 18. For I know him. Wouldn't that be a wonderful thing to have God say that about us? I know him. I know how he thinks. I know his character. I know how he lives, the patterns and the trends in his life. I can count on what he will do in any given situation. I know him. He's got some problems. He's not perfect. But his attitude and his direction and his life is right and good. And his faith in me is strong. And his diligence in trying to follow what I teach him in his life and in his home is outstanding. I know him. Verse 19, for I know him that he will command his children and his household after him, as for me and my house. And they shall keep the way of the Lord to do justice and judgment, that the Lord may bring upon Abraham that which he has spoken of him. Why? Because I know him, and he and his household will do justice and judgment, and they will keep the way of the Lord. In other words, as for me and my house, we will serve the Eternal. We must make sure that God is at the center of our lives and of our family. Just like Joshua said, and just like Abraham was and did, and just like Mr. and Mrs. Armstrong followed, and I believe we're following, but we want to get stronger in this area, stronger in our marriages, stronger in our families, because that's going to make all the difference in the world in terms of the congregation as a whole and in terms of carrying out the mission and the commission that God has given us to do. So we've come a good ways. Now let's take it all the way and see how that can be done. We must make sure that God is at the very center of our lives and of our family. Serving him involves the fear of God and walking closely with him all the time. It's put very well right over here in Malachi chapter 3 and verse 16. A truly wonderful section of Scripture. Verse 16 of Malachi chapter 3. Then they that feared the Eternal spoke often one to another, and the Lord hearkened and heard it, and a book of remembrance was written before him for them that feared the Eternal and that thought upon his name. You know, we talked about the urge to fear God, to stand in awe of God, to worship God, to respect God, to obey God. I just want you to notice some of the things that that leads to. It's all good. Then they that feared the Eternal spoke often one to another, and the Lord hearkened. See, it leads to that, God hearkening. And heard it. And a book of remembrance was written before him for them that feared the Eternal and that meditated upon his name, and they shall be mine, says the Lord of hosts, in that day when I make up my jewels, my special treasure, and I will spare them as a man spares his own son that serves him. Then shall you return and discern between the righteous and the wicked, between him that serves God and him that serves him not. That's the choice. Serve God, serve him not. As for me and my house, we will serve God, or as for me and my house, we will not serve God. That's the choice. I know which choice we want to make. I know which choice we are making. We are choosing to serve God as individuals and as families and as a church. But we have to take a look at where we can do that better. See, one of the main targets of attack from Satan the devil is the family. He wants to attack marriages. He wants to attack families. He wants to drive wedges between husbands and wives and parents and children and children and children and families and grandparents and so on. And he wants to drive wedges and splits and rifts between members of the family of God, which is the church of God. And we're not going to let him do that, but we want to make sure that we are doing what God says to prevent that from ever happening. But how can we do that in a practical, workable way? It's a very, very interesting discussion. It's a very, very lengthy discussion. In fact, there's so much to it that we're going to have to keep coming back to it again and again. But as we discuss it, how can we bring it to the point of being practical, of being workable on a day-by-day basis? I just want to start by saying this. It's not going to be easy. It's not going to be easy. Being an outstanding father and an outstanding mother and outstanding parents and grandparents and outstanding children and family and Christian and church member, it's not easy. In fact, it's so difficult, we'll never be able to do it if we do not humbly submit to God and ask Him to help us do it. But we have to put forth effort. It's more than worth all of the effort that we put into it. It takes determination. It takes consistency. We have to decide, I want to be an outstanding mother. I want to be an outstanding wife. I want to be an outstanding father. I want to be an outstanding husband. We want to be outstanding parents. We want to be wonderful, strong, beautiful, outstanding sons and daughters. And then we follow the instructions in the Bible, and we keep on growing in that area. And we make a little bit of progress, and we make a little more progress, and we slip up and have to repent, and then we make a little more progress, and we keep on going. And then we can look back and say, you know what? We were there and now we're here, and look at the benefits and the blessings and the happiness and the joy that comes with that. And look how pleased God's going to be with this. But it's not going to be convenient. It's going to be inconvenient. It's not going to be comfortable. It's going to get uncomfortable. And there's going to be some frustration involved and some misunderstandings. But as we make headway, the joy and the thrills, and the fulfillment of seeing it all start to come together is like nothing else that I know of. And that's the stuff of which the true church of God is made, and the family of God will be made for all eternity. Here's a very important and basic principle to keep in mind as we begin to explore me and my house. Let's turn to Romans chapter 8. Romans chapter 8 and verse 5. There's so many places in the Bible where God reduces everything down to choosing between two ways. Of course, Mr. Armstrong certainly clarified this when he talked about the two trees so often, which is a matter of choosing between two ways of life, the tree of life and the tree of death. But there are other places where this dichotomy is mentioned. And here's one. Romans chapter 8 and verse 5, for they that are after the flesh do mind the things of the flesh. They tend physical things. They set their minds on physical matters. But they that are after the Spirit, the things of the Spirit, they set their mind on spiritual things. Verse 6, for to be carnally minded is death. That's where it leads to. There may be pleasure. There may be certain titillations along the way. But it's all going to fall down and lead to death in the end. But to be spiritually minded is life and peace. And the pleasure that comes with that and the sensations that come with that and the joy and the happiness that come with that, there's no kickback. There's nothing bad about it. So that's the kind of families that we want. And that's the kind of leadership in the families that has to be there. Spiritually minded. In other words, tending to the spiritual things. Not focused on the physical things. There's time to pay attention to the physical things, but our focus, our concentration, our direction is about spiritually minded choices and thoughts and words and actions in the marriage, in the family, and in our lives. That's what you find when you study the life of Joshua. That's what you find when you study the life of Abraham. And that's also what you find when you study the life of Mr. and Mrs. Herbert Armstrong. Their exuberance, their excitement, their joy, their happiness, their abundant lives had to do with spiritual things first, including in their marriage and including in their family. This takes planning. This takes discussion. This takes commitment. What we're talking about here is a family project. Sitting down and going over where we've come from, where we are now, where we want to go, and how we're going to get there as a family. And everybody discussing it and talking about it and thinking about it. And then you begin to see a plan start to form. Here's what we have to do. Here's the way we're going to do that. And we're going to help one another do that. this planning and this commitment will pull the whole family into it, and this becomes an exciting, wonderful, lifelong project. And it involves love and telling one another that you love each other and encouraging one another and appreciating one another and recognizing the good things that each one in the family does, but also taking a look at ways that each one in the family can improve. Now, this is just a start. I plan to keep on going through this subject from time to time and mine it and mine it and then mine it some more for everything it's worth, because Mr. Armstrong did this. And we're going to have to. And it's in the Bible. And it's all a part of getting fully back on track and then going down the track at full speed. And when you can come to the point to where the families in God's church are growing more and more pleasing in God's sight, that's who makes up the church and the work. And so therefore, the church and the work become more pleasing in God's sight. And then the benefits and blessings and joy and happiness and peace of mind and thrills and excitement and eventually being given entrance into the family of God make all of it worthwhile. But I repeat, we have to be serious about it. This is going to take a determined discussion and decision. Look, this is what we're going to do. We must do it. And if we do it, God's going to bless us. And if we don't do it, we're just going to get into more and more of a position of drifting and drifting and finally just starting to fade and disintegrate. And we don't want that. And God doesn't want that. Well, let's start with getting specific, not too specific, but somewhat specific as far as this opening message is concerned on this subject. Let's see a few points and a few scriptures along the lines of fathers and husbands. Fathers and husbands. I can't imagine more fulfilling and more really important responsibilities in God's eyes and in life than someone who humbles himself, yields to God, and follows Jesus Christ, and becomes an outstanding father and an outstanding husband. If someday God says, you were a good father and you were a good husband, that's great. I hope to hear that. I really do. What a compliment. Is it a compliment in today's society? How many people think so-and-so over here is really a fine father, and so-and-so over here is just really a fine husband, is as important as, well, so-and-so over here is a CEO over a company that's making $10 million a year. And so-and-so over here is an outstanding sports figure that leads a winning team. I'll take father and husband over CEO and outstanding athlete any day. But it's not glamorous. It's not jazzy. It's not held in high esteem in society today except for a certain few. Fathers are made fun of. Husbands are made fun of. Quite often, just the butt of jokes. Not by everybody, but by a lot. But not by God. Let's turn to 1 Timothy chapter 5. 1 Timothy chapter 5. And verse 8. Here's how important being the leader of the house is. And the husband and father is the leader of the house if we're going to follow what God says. He's the leader of the family. He's the leader of the home. 1 Timothy chapter 5 and verse 8. If any provide not for his own, and especially for those of his own house or household, he has denied the faith and is worse than an infidel or unbeliever. Now that's quite a privilege and quite an honor and quite an opportunity to be a husband and father if we step up. But if we don't, God says we've denied the faith and we're worse than an infidel or an unbeliever. That's pretty serious and sobering. But if any provide not for his own, and especially for those of his own house, he has denied the faith and he's worse than an infidel. Now if you take it in context, yes, it's talking about home and hearth and food and clothing and needs in that area. But it also involves providing leadership, guidance, direction, example, love, concern, teaching, correction, direction to the household as well. And if he doesn't, he's denied the faith and he's worse than an infidel. So it's not exactly that, well, if you can if you want to, but if you don't want to, that's fine. If you're going to be a Christian and if I'm going to be a Christian. Now God will help us in this. Still talking about fathers and husbands, let's turn over here to 1 Peter chapter 3. 1 Peter chapter 3 and verse 7. Likewise, you husbands, dwell with them, meaning the wife, according to knowledge. Or in other words, with understanding. Or in other words, according to what God says. Giving honor unto the wife. You probably heard this before. I've heard it. Where husbands will be talking. You know, men will be talking, sitting around talking. And they'll start putting down their wives. And they'll start making criticisms and remarks about their wives. I can't understand it. It's just amazing to me every time I hear that. And they'll call her, well, you know, the old lady. You know, she's this way and she's that way and she says this and does that. No, brother. But God says giving honor unto the wife. Honor unto the wife. Respect. Appreciation. And it's thinking it, but it's also saying it. I have to ask myself, when is the last time I really gave honor to my wife? I said it and I showed it. And I do it often, do I? I have to ask myself that. And the husbands have to ask themselves that. Because it says right here, giving honor unto the wife. Respecting her. Appreciating her. Admiring her. Thanking her. Listening to her. Learning from her. As unto the weaker vessel. Not mentally weak, not emotionally weak, not spiritually weak, and not even physically weak. But because of the way God made the man and the woman, the man has stronger physical strength, muscles, tendons, bones, etc. by design. That's good. But going on, and as being heirs together of the grace of life, that your prayers be not hindered. Together. Pursuing eternal life. Praying together. Studying together. Encouraging one another. Pointing out problems to one another in love. And things that would be good to change in love. And the husband taking the lead and honoring his wife and doing it in front of the children. Not phony, not silly, but doing it. And the children see it happening. Not all the time, not every time. There's other ways to honor your wife and nobody even sees that taking place. But a lot of times, without making a big production about it, others will see that this husband is honoring his wife. And the children will see, my dad is honoring my mom. And he appreciates her. In the family I grew up in, with 9 children and a mother and a dad, and a long table, and at one end my dad and my mom sitting right beside him, and at the other end a bench with one of my brothers, and then me sitting on that bench where they had to build a riser on the bench so I could reach the table. We all came in and sat down at the table together, and usually my dad was there from the beginning, but if not, he came in a little bit late. We waited for him. He came in and sat down, and he asked God's blessing. And sometimes he'd ask someone else to ask God's blessing. And then we enjoyed the meal together. It wasn't combat. It wasn't warfare. It was pleasant. There was discussions, and there was talking, and there was sharing the meal and passing things. And the custom at our house and in other houses is instead of saying, well, please pass the bread or can I have the peas and potatoes? You'd say, thank you for the bread and thank you for the peas and thank you for the potatoes. You thank them even before they passed it. Thank you for the biscuits. That's what we'd say. And when I got older and went other places and I'd say that, people look at me like it just came natural. But here's one thing that was absolutely a practice in our house. Started with my dad. Now, can you imagine how much work went into providing that breakfast and then turn right around providing that lunch and then turn right around providing that supper? And my mom did it 3 times a day faithfully, and it was delicious. And when we finished up, when you pushed away from the table, you said, thank you for the meal. Thank you for the supper. Thank you very much. Everybody did it, including my dad, to my mother, and honored her in that way. Well, here's another verse I want to consider regarding admonitions to fathers, of which I'm one, happily so. Ephesians chapter 6. I wonder how often mom is thanked for what she does around the house. Sincerely, I hope we thank her for all she does. And sometimes, out of nowhere, we walk up and give her a big hug and say, thank you. I'm glad you're my mother. I'm glad you're my wife. Thank you for keeping our clothes clean and the house up and the meals. Thank you for being there. I think we do that, but let's do it more. And fathers, let's think about this. Ephesians chapter 6 and verse 4. And you fathers, provoke not your children to wrath. I've seen fathers pick on their kids and make fun of their kids and compare their kids with other kids and try to make them mad or ridicule them. Well, God says don't do that. But here's what he does say do. But bring them up in the nurture and admonition of the Lord. Now we're talking about a responsibility that God says fathers are to carry out in the home. Remember, as for me and my house? So how are we as fathers going to bring our children up in the nurture and admonition of the Lord? This is going to take time. It takes patience. It takes commitment. It takes love. And there are practical things we can do. But let's start off by recognizing the fact that that's a very important duty of the father. Bring them up, your children, in the nurture and admonition of the Lord. What about mothers and wives? What are some verses that in particular refer to them? Mothers and wives. Let's turn to 1 Thessalonians chapter 2. 1 Thessalonians chapter 2 and verse 7. Paul is talking about how he related to God's people, but in order to make that plain, he used an example of a mother who loves her children. So we can learn about a mother who loves her children by reading the example that he used to show the kind of love the ministers have for the brethren. It says here in 1 Thessalonians chapter 2 and verse 7, but we were gentle among you. I don't know of anybody that can be more gentle and more kind and more soothing and more comforting than a loving mother. There's just something there. There's a touch there that a mother has that is special. I've seen children that are just about out of control, and loving mothers take care of them, pick them up, start talking to them, and nobody can settle them down like the mother can. First thing you know, they start settling down and calming down and relaxing, and the whole thing gets turned around because of that gentle, caring, loving touch that the mother has. For we were gentle among you, even as a nurse cherishes her children. That's a mistranslation. It should read nursing mother. Nursing mother. Taking care of that little baby, comforting that little baby, loving that little baby, feeding that baby, talking to that baby, soothing that baby, as only a mother can do. And then as that child weans off and needs to be taught other things. See, one of the main things a father provides in a home is leadership. One of the main things a mother provides in a home is education. One of the main things children do in a home is being learners. These are not all the things, but those are some of the most important things. And here you see a mother that cherishes her children. Verse 8, so being affectionately desirous of you, longing for you, we are willing or well pleased to have imparted unto you not the gospel of God only, but also our own lives, because you were dear unto us. Well, I'll tell you, children who have a loving mother know that they're very dear to her and remain that way throughout her life and throughout their life. And that mother's love is some of the strongest love there is. There are things that God has given women, mothers, wives to do and the ability to do that no one else can do that way. It's just not possible. Here's one of my favorite examples of that. Let's turn over here to Proverbs chapter 31. Proverbs 31. You know, recapturing true values in the family, getting back on track with a household, renewing a family that has God in the center of it is a project and is a quest and a mission that we're going to start really spending time on in God's church. And I hope you'll all begin thinking about that and praying about that and studying about that, and realize that we're talking about different responsibilities in the family based on the fear of God or the awe of God or the obedience to God. You show me a wife that fears God, I'll show you a good wife. You show me a mother that fears God, I'll show you a good mother. Same with a husband, same with a father. It leads to action. It leads to someone who's going to say, well, if God says do it, I'm going to do it. If God says this is what I should do as a mother and as a wife, that's what, with his help, I'm going to follow. Now, this could mean change. Change is not easy. When we get set in our ways, it's hard to change. You know, you go out west, there's a place called the Petrified Forest. It doesn't mean it's a scared forest. It doesn't mean the trees are scared. They're just petrified. It means that they have turned to stone. I mean, they are set. They've hardened. And that's the way they are. And we can become petrified Christians. And it's hard to crack that, but we have to and can with God's Spirit. Now let's just read here in Proverbs chapter 31. Shall we read this and shall we begin to take a look at it and start to move in the direction that we see? Or shall we just kind of blot this out? No, in God's church, we live by every word of God. Now, mothers and wives, take a look at this. Proverbs 31:10. Who can find a virtuous woman, for her price is far above rubies? My wife and I were talking about some of the strongest people in the church are the women. And that's not always the case. Very strong, godly women. And I'm thankful for that. But, ladies, can you progress and become even more of a virtuous woman? Yes, you can. For her price is far above rubies. Now, here's what a virtuous woman does. The heart of her husband does safely trust in her so that he shall have no need of spoil. He can give her credit cards and he can give her the keys to the car and he can say, I'll see you later, and know that she's not going to destroy the budget and destroy the family. I have personally been in counselings in families where the husband, loving his wife, gets a credit card and gives her one. So now they both have a credit card. And before long, I get a call to go back over there, and she has totally maxed out the credit card and put them so hopelessly in debt that it looks like there's no way out. But a virtuous woman is one that can be trusted. She's not going to do that. She's going to keep in touch with her husband. They're going to work together on everything. She will do him good and not evil all the days of her life. And she thinks about how she can do her husband good. She thinks about that. She prays about it. She seeks wool and flax and works willingly with her hands. She's not lazy. And she enthusiastically works in the household and for the family. She's like the merchant ship. She brings her food from afar. She rises also while it is yet night and gives food to her household and a portion to her maids. She feeds her children. She feeds the family. She learns how to cook and learns how to cook well. And she realizes this is one of her main responsibilities. And you know what? That might be something that some of the ladies, and especially the young women, will need to do, because women being good cooks has kind of gone out of fashion. And I've never met a man that doesn't just love experiencing the good cooking of his wife. See, it says, a prudent wife is from the eternal. It also says, he that finds a wife finds a good thing. And I'll tell you, and I've talked to men about it many times, if she is a good cook or she learns how to be a good cook, boy, that's a blessing. Now the food's going to be good. It's going to be safe. It's going to be healthy. She's going to plan the meals. Each meal in the home is an important part of the day. We sit down to the table as a family and we eat good food prepared by somebody we trust, our mother and our wife. And the food is good and it's healthy. Well, that's what it says right here about the virtuous woman, verse 15. Verse 16, she considers a field and buys it. With the fruit of her hand, she plants a vineyard. That doesn't mean she goes out and says, well, I see some property over there. I think that's a good piece of property. Yeah, I'll buy it. And then surprise her husband when he gets back home. No, she's capable of carrying out a big project. But it's something that her husband approves of and something her husband backs her up in. And she researches it. She finds out the facts, and her husband can trust her to handle something like that. She girds her loins with strength and strengthens her arm. She perceives that her merchandise is good. Her candle goes not out by night. She does what needs to be done. Doesn't mean she ruins her health. She lays her hands to the spindle, and her hands hold the distaff. In other words, she learns how to sew. She learns how to cook and does well. She stretches out her hand to the poor. She has mercy. She has compassion. Yea, she reaches forth her hands to the needy. She's not afraid of the snow for her household, for all her household are clothed with scarlet. She starts thinking, well, cold weather's coming. I'm going to have to get some heavier clothes for my children. and for my husband. And the kids are growing, so they're going to have bigger shoes and bigger boots. And she takes care of that. Or the summer's coming. Well, they're going to have lighter clothes. See, she's thinking about this. She makes herself coverings of tapestry. Her clothing is silk and purple. She tries to look neat and nice. Her husband is known in the gates when he sits among the elders of the land because he's married to a virtuous woman. She helps him look sharp, be sharp, and feel sharp. I've seen it happen. I've seen men that come into the church and they are country bumpkins and hayseeds from way back. And they meet a young woman that begins to be attracted to them and they get to know one another. And she's capable and she learns different things. And first thing you know, she learns how to cook and how to sew and she learns how to decorate. And she develops the ability to take care of a house and a home. And they grow in their love for one another and they get married. And my wife will vouch for me when I say this. I'm thinking of one man in particular, but I can mention others not by name. And this man looked like, what's happening here? His hair started to be the right length and he'd come to church and it was combed, parted in the right way. His clothes were clean and pressed and his tie. He got to where he could tie a tie and his shoes were shined. He turned into a fine man and a leader. It wasn't that his wife did it all for him. It's that he was inspired to do it by her and then she helped him. It's amazing how a virtuous woman can impact the whole family. It's wonderful. They can add things to a family and to a marriage nobody else can add. They have a touch given to them by God, but it won't be there and it won't be productive if she doesn't stand in awe of God and put it to the right use and cheerfully so and love every minute of it or love the results of the hard work that it entails. Verse 24, she makes fine linen and sells it and delivers girdles unto the merchant. In other words, she can do things and pick up extra money when necessary. Strength and honor are her clothing, and she shall rejoice in time to come. That's what verse 25 says. Does it mean it? Yes, it means it. Strength and honor are her clothing, the virtuous woman. And she shall rejoice in time to come, the virtuous woman. Because God will bless her, and that will spill off onto her husband and children. She opens her mouth with wisdom, not prittle, prattle, and gossip, but interesting things. And in her tongue is the law of kindness. She looks well to the ways of her household, in her area of responsibility, subject to her husband, and eats not the bread of idleness. And look what happens as far as her children are concerned. Her children arise up and call her blessed, her husband also, and he praises her. Her family loves her and respects her and thanks her and praises her. That's the kind of family I grew up in. One of the most important members of our family was my mother. And that's true as far as my dad is concerned and true as far as all nine of her children are concerned. And that's the way it can be in all families, especially in God's church where we're trying to bring our families to the point that God wants our families to come to. If we're God-centered, it's not just that we pray and study and sing hymns and shout amen and hallelujah. It's that we put into practice in practical terms what God lays out in terms of these guidelines in the Bible. And God then blesses that. And I think we are doing it. But I think we can also improve. Verse 29, many daughters have done virtuously or well, but you excel them all. Now, you don't go around just bragging about your wife and bragging about your kids, but you tell her and you tell them how much you love them and how you appreciate what she does. And the kids tell her that too. Favor is deceitful and beauty is vain. But notice this now. But a woman that fears the Eternal, see how Proverbs 31 and the virtuous woman starts to come down to the bottom line? What is the bottom line? But a woman that fears the Eternal, she shall be praised. And I remember Mr. Armstrong going through this and explaining that it means more than just she shall be praised. It probably also means that she shall be saved. In other words, she's going to be in the kingdom. Give her of the fruit of her hands and let her own works praise her in the gates. She's the homemaker. She's the family keeper. She's one of the main educators. 1 Peter chapter 3. That's the mother. What about the wife? 1 Peter chapter 3 and verse 1. Now, here's the thing. I know that we have to work at all of this, and I know that it takes time. But if we start working at it, we're going to progress. We are. And then we're going to be blessed. And the fruits will just blossom. And the happiness, and the peace of mind, and the joy, and all the thrills that God builds into a family like we're reading about here will come to fruition. But it takes patience. It takes determination. It takes commitment. It takes being willing to change where we see we need to change. I'm not making any of this up. We're reading it right here in God's Word. So we have to read it and study it and internalize it and absorb it, and then with God's help begin to try to practice it little by little. We all have to be patient with one another. Starts with the attitude, and then the actions follow. 1 Peter chapter 3 and verse 1. Likewise, you wives, be in subjection to your own husbands, that if any obey not the word, they also may without the word be won by the conversation or conduct of the wives. And I've seen that happen. But I've also seen a wife conduct herself so well that her husband, who is converted, gets even stronger in the church. I remember examples of husbands that come to me and they say, well, I was really starting to flounder spiritually. I was neglecting my Bible study and prayer, but my wife didn't nag at me. She just kept on getting hers done. She'd go in and, well, where is she? Oh, she's somewhere private, and she's in there praying. And without blowing a trumpet and waving a flag, he'd look around and she'd be sitting over there close to a lamp studying her Bible. And he said, look what she's doing. I better get going. And her example had an impact to where he began to go into a private place and pray and open his Bible and study. And then in addition to that, they were starting to do it together. Well, that's what verse 1 of 1 Peter 3 says. That's how much impact a loving wife can have and a loving mother can have. While they behold your chaste conduct coupled with fear of God, awe of God. Whose adorning, let it not be the outward adorning of plaiting the hair. It's okay to plait the hair, but that's not the main thing. And of wearing of gold or a putting on of apparel. Of course, that's all part of it. But what we're talking about here is what's inside the character. Verse 4. But let it be the hidden man or the hidden person or the hidden woman of the heart in that which is not corruptible, even the ornament of a meek or gentle and quiet spirit, which is in the sight of God of great price. Doesn't mean that the wife doesn't talk. Of course she does. But she also can be quiet and gentle and knows the appropriate time for that to take place. For after this manner in the old time, the holy women also, notice they were called holy women. Wouldn't you love to be called a holy woman of God? The holy women also who trusted in God. They trusted in God. They trusted in God to take care of them, and they trusted in God to bless the household and to guide the husband, and they trusted in God in terms of the government in the home, who trusted in God, adorned themselves, being in subjection unto their own husbands. Even as Sarah obeyed Abraham, calling him Lord, or just respected him, that's all. Once again, have you ever heard this? I've heard it. I've heard women talking. And I've heard them start to put down their husbands, make fun of their husbands, take cheap shots at their husband and talk about, oh, my old man this and my old man that, my old man the other thing. That is so disgusting. That's not the way a godly woman talks. Even as Sarah obeyed Abraham, calling him Lord, whose daughters you are, as long as you do well and are not afraid with any amazement. So there's some basic guidelines for mothers and wives. What about parents? Does the Bible have very much to say about parents? Oh, it has a lot to say about parents. Let's turn to Deuteronomy chapter 6. What a beautiful thing when parents work together in caring for their children. It's just wonderful. And if they need to work something out, they do it in private. They don't put down one another before the children. They don't argue before the children. They don't settle things before the children. They do that in private, and hopefully it's not arguing. But they're together in working with the children. I learned that lesson pretty quickly when we started having our children, and my wife and I would be having fun, and sometimes we would tease one another in a way that looked like we were kind of mad, and our children would be playing in the house or in the living room, and all of a sudden, just the tone of our voices toward one another, they would stop everything they're doing and watch. They thought, wow, what's happening with our parents? And so we began to quickly understand that we can have fun in the right way. We can have fun in a way that cannot be misunderstood and mistaken. We weren't really cutting one another down, but we didn't even want any possibility of the children thinking that was happening to be there. Children get a little uneasy if they think things are not exactly right between mom and dad. So that has to be looked after and made sure that everything gets settled so it's right between mom and dad, and then children can relax. They're secure. They know their dad's going to take care of them, the mom's going to take care of them, and their mom and dad are together. They're a team. They are parents looking after the children. Deuteronomy chapter 6 and verse 6. And these words which I command you this day shall be in your heart. They shall be a part of your innermost being. In other words, they are a part of you. Verse 7. And you shall teach them diligently unto your children. What about that? Teach them diligently unto your children. And you shall talk of them when you sit in your house, and when you walk by the way, and when you lie down, and when you rise up. You teach them everything you can about God. When they're born, they don't know anything about God, and they don't know anything about God's way. But you start teaching them. It's not that you lecture them, and that you sit them down and say, be still, and you start quoting scripture and try to force feed them. But it's a way of life. By example, you show how this is the way to do this, and we don't do it that way. And sometimes you point it out verbally. When you're outside working and you see a hummingbird, or you plant a tree, or you see a rain cloud coming, you can make observations about it. Isn't that beautiful? Wow, look at that. Isn't that special? And that can lead to a discussion about design and how God is a great designer. You might go back into the house when it starts raining and pull out a book and say, look what it says about a hummingbird here. See how the wing is designed and how the bone structure is there and how many times he flaps his wings in a minute and how he can go up and down and around and back and forth. God is the one who made him that way. And that leads to other things like principles to live by. Loving God and loving neighbor. Doing this and it works. Don't do that, it doesn't work. Because this commandment here says do this and it says don't do that. It's that kind of thing. That's the atmosphere around the house. Let's notice Deuteronomy 4 and verse 9 while we're here. Deuteronomy 4 and verse 9. We'll talk about the extended family, but this is a whole project, this matter of family. Grandparents don't interfere with parents. Grandparents back up parents. But they too are a part of the teaching process toward children. Sometimes they'll point out something. Other times, just by example. Look at this. Deuteronomy chapter 4 and verse 9. Only take heed to yourself and keep your soul or your life diligently, lest you forget the things which your eyes have seen, Deuteronomy 4, 9, and lest they depart from your heart all the days of your life. But look what it says here. Notice, teach them your sons and your sons' sons. Teach them to your children and teach them to your grandchildren. It goes on, and God blesses that. I was asked at a spokesman's club one night before a packed house, if you could teach your children only one thing, what would it be? And I instantly got up and said, let's turn to Ecclesiastes chapter 12 and verse 13. Now, there's many more things that we want to teach our children. We love them deeply and dearly. But if there was only one thing, then this is what I said I would teach them. Ecclesiastes 12 and verse 13. Let us hear the conclusion of the whole matter. Fear God, stand in awe of God, love God, appreciate God, worship God, listen to God, obey God, fear God. That's all in there. And keep his commandments. Do what he says. For this is the whole duty of man, or this is man's all. If we, as parents, can grow in our fear of God and in our obedience to God and can teach our children to do that, we are really accomplishing something. Continuing in the area of parents as far as a house that has God in the center, let's turn to Proverbs chapter 22. And this is all done in love. And don't lose sight of the fact that it really works. It really pays off. It's so much fun. I can remember when our children started crawling, and then they would start to pull up, but they couldn't walk yet. So we would take them by the hands and kind of walk with them. And then we would just hold them by one arm, and they would walk. And then first thing you know, you're watching, and they stand up in the middle of the room, but they won't do anything. They're just standing there, kind of wobbly. You're watching. And then one day you watch, and they take a step. And then they take another step. And then one day they walk across the room. Aren't you pleased? Isn't it great? What a big day. What a big day. I've come home before, and my wife says, guess what? So-and-so walked today. It's like a tremendous event. And it was. They learned to walk. Then first thing you know, they're walking really well. Then first thing you know, they're running. The same thing is true when they start to grow and get older and they learn how to tie their shoes, learn how to write, learn how to speak clearly, learn how to logically put things together. Well, if this means that and that means that, then that means this has to mean that. First thing you know, they're growing up. They're going to learn how to drive and drive safely and drive well. And they might be able to start playing a musical instrument or building a cabinet. And they're growing up into adulthood, and they become accomplished, successful children. And you, parents, mother and dad, had a tremendous part in that. Now, they had to do a lot of it themselves, but you had a tremendous part in it. And what a thrill that is. What a blessing. It's not that we thump our chest and brag about our kids. We're just happy that we could be part of it. And God is pleased when he sees his children being trained and responding. Notice what it says here, Proverbs 22:6. What responsibility is more rewarding and more important than this? Train up a child in the way he should go, and when he is old, he will not depart from it. In other words, we are to be equipping our children for life. There are just so many things in our society today that people spend their lives doing that are worthless. They don't amount to anything. They don't achieve anything. They don't accomplish anything. They don't produce anything. They come and go, make a lot of money, live in a big house, drive a long car, but what did their life amount to? But you show me parents that really do well in parenting their children, and they keep on trying, and they keep on succeeding little by little. That is a magnificent responsibility. I know as children get older, they may choose to go the hard way. Don't beat yourself up over that. You did the best you could. And you continue to love them. Because somewhere down the road, they're going to turn and come back. And it'll be easier for them to come back because you continue to love them. All you can do as parents is just try to do what God says all the time that you have the authority over them. And the likelihood of them following what you taught them and with God's involvement and their direction, it's going to be a wonderful thing to see how happy they are and how well-equipped they are for life. Here's just a few things to consider in this matter of parenting. Remember, when our children are born, they don't know the right hand from the left hand. So they've got to be taught the work ethic. Not to work too hard, but to work and enjoy it and to work smart. And they have to be taught to do what they do well. And enjoy doing it well. Now, that means they're going to have to learn. It takes time. And for the little girls, we need to bring back teaching them how to cook and keeping the home and how to know their way around a kitchen, not mingling different kinds of food and meats and making sure that they keep the utensils where they belong and the pots and pans where they belong and they're careful with the stove and they don't have a boiling pot of hot water with a handle sticking out like this and then another one of the kids can come in and pull it right down on them. We teach safety in the kitchen. What a beautiful thing. I remember going to some member's house one time and they had invited me to dinner and I didn't know this was going to happen. And we sat down in the living room and talked for a while. And the dad said, well, we turned the key to the kitchen over to our daughter. So she's prepared the meal tonight. She had an apron on and we went in there and there was a tablecloth and setting. We all sat down and she started serving the meal and it was just wonderful. What a treat. What a blessing. Her mother just kept on teaching her as she started growing and I'll tell you, I'll bet you right now she's a wonderful homemaker. One of the things that is out the window that we need to bring back in the door is we need to teach girls to be ladylike, to be feminine. I don't mean sissy, but to be feminine, femininity. And we need to teach the boys to be masculine. I don't mean macho tough guy, but I mean being masculine. I'm a boy, I like being a boy. I'm a girl, I like being a girl. And they need to be taught that. I'm getting into specifics, but it's important. We need to teach our children hygiene and how to practice good hygiene. Brush their teeth. Floss. They weren't born knowing this. Keep their fingernails clean. Hang their clothes up. Put their clothes in the chest of drawers, etc. We need to teach our children how to play and have fun. How to throw a ball, catch a ball, bat. The game that has rules to it. So you learn how to follow the rules. And you learn how to lose without getting mad and depressed. And how to win without getting pompous and arrogant. And so you have fun at the game. And you know that there are things that the game allows you to do and things that the game doesn't allow you to do. And if you're going to play the game well, you got to understand those things. We teach them how. What I'd like to see make a comeback is less and less of people in the home being wired and more of the people in the home playing games where everybody participates. There's a lot of them that are a lot of fun. We grew up where we didn't have very much money, but we didn't care. We still had fun. One of our favorite games was called Andy Over. And I remember this rubber ball that was used so much it started having whole chunks out of it. I wish I could find it. And some of the kids would get on one side of the house and some would get on the other side of the house and you'd yell, Andy Over, and you'd throw the ball over. And then you try to get to that side of the house without them taking the rubber ball, which wouldn't hurt you, and hitting you with it. And if you threw it and it didn't go over, and I was so little, sometimes it wouldn't go over, I'd have to yell pigtail, which means it came back down. And our house was up on blocks, so of course we looked under to see which way the kids were running. You know how you work all that out. In the house, we would play Monopoly. We'd play hearts. You know, Mr. Armstrong loved playing hearts. Games like that, chess, checkers, those are fun games. Dominoes. I heard a report on the news about a book that's been written about Sarah Palin. I'm not getting into politics here, but anyway, they researched it, and they were a poor family up in Alaska, and their dad wouldn't buy a television, so they finally talked him into it. So he bought a television, and he put it in the coldest room in the house, and the only way you could go in and watch the television is if you split some wood first and went in and had a fire in there, then you could watch the television. Around their house, they would sit and read to one another. Oh, let me tell you this. Listen to this. Here's what I'm reading over here. Oh, that's great. Well, here's what I'm reading over here. And they took turns washing dishes. And while one was in there washing dishes, the rest were in there singing. It was a family. It was a family. At our house, the big thing was front porch or back porch or fireplace. And then later piano and singing around the piano. It's so much fun to be involved as a family. And we need to teach our children how to have fun by having fun with them. Music and manners, how to eat, use the fork, use the knife, not the hands. How to set the plate, how not to fill their mouth so full, how not to smack, how not to chew with their mouth open. This may sound silly, but it's not because they need to be taught this. All of these things were emphasized at Ambassador College. I remember really well sitting at breakfast one time in the dining room called Mayfair, and everybody else had to go to a class, and I was taking a little longer to eat. And one of the things they had at college was grapefruit, which not too many of us could afford. And at this table, it would seat about five on this side and five on that side, with one down at that end, one down at this end. I was the only one left still eating. I'd already eaten my grapefruit, and I was eating eggs and bread. And this one big guy was at that end of the table. I later found out he was really, really poor, and he'd never had any grapefruit. And since all the students had gone, just me and him were sitting there, there were grapefruit left on the table that weren't touched. And so he took this grapefruit, and he took his knife, and he stabbed it that way, and he poked it in there and put it in his mouth. Then he took the rind, and he bent it this way, and he just chewed on that rind, Then he got another grapefruit. He did that again. He just went through two or three grapefruits. When he got done, he had grapefruit juice on his face, dripping down. He turned around to me and says, "Would you excuse me, please?" And left. Well, the next day, here's what I saw on the food line. The vice president of the student body was there with him. And he was kind and gentle. But he went through the food line with him, just quietly. When they sat down at the table, he said, "No, you don't leave your spoon in your cup. No, you don't pour your coffee in the saucer, pick it up, sip it, and that's not what we do here." And little by little, he brought him around. And you know what happened? He began to respond and change. He learned how to tie a tie. He learned how to eat. He learned how to speak properly in club. And then we graduated, but I followed him. He turned out really well and ended up either as a minister or as a leader because he was teachable, because he was taught gently and kindly but clearly on how to comport himself. Well, we have to do that with our children. He'd never had that kind of training at home, but he got it at college. And now he could work in society and make his way. Teach our children how to have respect for authority, to think safety, to use common sense, to learn how to share without being taken advantage of, to have class without being snobs. Teach them skills and poise and to ask the right questions and how to practice discipline in their lives. Say no when they should say no and yes when they should say yes. All of this is part of parental training. Compliment them. Encourage them. Reassure them. Let them know that you're there with them in all of this. And you're participating with them. Tell them you're learning as well and that you had to learn all these things. It's fun. And they'll like it. And then as they get to where they can do it, you can just enjoy watching them do these things. Operate this piece of machinery. Get that work done over there. Paint this wall. Explain this mathematical problem. Point out this point, this place on the map. Explain this verse. It's so rewarding. And now all your hard work comes right back, and everybody will enjoy it. I want to stop right there, and we will continue next time. This could be a 10-part sermon. I don't know. But I'm doing it in love, and I'm doing it because I believe it needs to be done for all of us and that it's good for the church. And I'm learning what I need to do along with all of you, I hope, right from God's Word. So we'll pray about it and think about it, study it, talk about it, and let's keep on working in this direction of growing in our lives and growing in our families so that all of us can sincerely say that as for me and for my house, we're going to serve God.